This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. This is your HedgeGhoul Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. Now, today we are discussing Spies and Informers Beware, Intelligence and Counterintelligence in the War of Independence. One of the most important and controversial aspects of the War of Independence was the intelligence war. Given the role of spies and informers in defeating previous insurrections, it is not surprising that Michael Collins, the IRA's Director of Intelligence, was keen to ensure that history did not repeat itself. How successful was he? What sort of resources and structures did he and his British opponents have at their disposal? To shed light on this shadow war, we're joined by Andy Bielenberg of UCC, author of many works, of course, related to the War of Independence. But for our purposes, he is a compiler, along with Jim Donnelly, of the Cork Fatality Index, and more on that later. We have Cecile Gordon of the Military Archives Military Service Pensions Collection. Eunan O'Halpin of Trinity College Dublin, co-author, along with Dahi O'Cronon, of the much-anticipated The Dead of the Irish Revolution. And that, by the way, will be reviewed in the March-April issue of History Ireland magazine. And finally, we have Gerry White, a former member of the Defence Forces and author of The Burning of Cork, Baptised in Blood, The Formation of Cork Brigade of the Irish Volunteers. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sports and Media under the Decade of Centenaries initiative. Now, Gerry White, just to get us started, before we get into the detail of the intelligence war and the War of Independence, let's talk a little bit about intelligence and counterintelligence in general. You're the man here with a military background. What did the teacher about this at cadet school? You know, what do we mean by intelligence, counterintelligence? Where does it fit in military operations?
Well, before we go into that, Tommy, I wanted to define two headings. First of all, we have information, okay, and intelligence. So information, I suppose you could define it as facts or knowledge about a particular individual, incident, circumstances, or location. And I suppose we could define intelligence as the collection of that information, how it's analysed, and what action is taken based on it. Now, modern intelligence, there's a whole series of components, which we won't go into because it's very scientific and technical. But for the purpose of the period under discussion, the War of Independence, intelligence would have had four main components: acquisition, analysis, implementation, and counterintelligence. Acquisition would be the process by which you gather intelligence from a whole variety of sources. Analysis is how it's looked at, analysed, to see what purpose it could be put, whether that's planning a military operation or indeed deciding government strategy. Implementation speaks for itself. That's the action that is taken based on the analysis of the intelligence. And of course, we have counterintelligence. You could define that, I suppose, at operations or activity aimed at disrupting or degrading enemy intelligence operations and thereby protecting your own intelligence service. When we look at acquisition, I suppose one of the main sources would be human intelligence. And in relation to the War of Independence, that brings up two words that have resonated down through the years, namely a spy or an informer. And I think it's important that we differentiate between the two of those. A spy would be somebody, I suppose, who would be on the inside of the organization, a member of the organization or somebody paid by the organization for a specific task, whereby an informer would be somebody outside the intelligence service, somebody who, for whatever reason, has decided to give information to the security forces that could be used against their opponents.
Now, what was the treatment of spies, say, in the Hague Convention, which was the international, you know, sort of the rules of war at that time?
Absolutely. Well, Chapter 2 of the Hague Convention, first of all, it defines a spy as follows. Chapter 2, Article 29, a person can only be considered a spy when, acting clandestinely or on false pretenses, he obtains or endeavours to obtain information in the zone of operations of a belligerent with the intention of communicating it to the hostile party. Now, Article 30 goes on to talk about the treatment of spies. Now, it's very vague and it only consists of one sentence, which is as follows. A spy taken in the act shall not be punished without previous trial. That's all it says. It does not go on to define the type of punishment.
Now, Jerry, that's interesting because I'm assuming that many of our listeners, including myself, were under the impression the spies were just taken out and shot out of hand, you know, were executed. That's obviously not the case, well, in theory at least.
Well, if there are numerous accounts made of the IRA capturing spies and being those spies being subjected to some sort of trial, obviously bearing in mind that the IRA was a guerrilla force. It didn't have a courthouse or a military headquarters whereby to conduct these trials. But there are, like I said, evidence of some sort of trial being conducted before they were executed.
Okay, Andy, just to move on to you and looking at the British side of this whole equation. And I just want to talk a little bit about the 1916 Rising, just as a case in point, because the 1916 Rising, from the rebels' point of view, was obviously a military failure, right? But from the British point of view, was it also an intelligence failure?
Yes, Tommy, from a British perspective, it was certainly an intelligence failure, and it illustrated a wider problem. The British Navy got information on the Rising, but it failed to share this adequately. And British intelligence in this period overall, of course, was much more preoccupied with the First World War and the German threat. So they weren't really taking the threat from Irish separatists very seriously.
Just maybe, Eunan, do you want to come in on that, right? Because you were talking about in the aftermath of the 1916 Rising, there was one or two things about it that surprised you. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, I will. But first of all, just to say, pick up what Andy said, the key intelligence that naval intelligence had, because they were then managing the new science almost of intercepting and decrypting German diplomatic traffic as well as German military and naval traffic. There's undoubtedly the material was in the hands of naval intelligence, which if it had been communicated to the castle, and if the castle had analysed it, because the castle, after all, they were stupid, but not that stupid, might have made more sense of it, and the Rising might have been thwarted. But there's also a point that the material that naval intelligence had is German communications, right? And in other words, it's an external power. And the problem for the rebels in 1916 was that the arrangements of the Rising were disclosed through German insecurity, not through rebel insecurity. Having said that, in the wake of the Rising, what's amazing, given what happens from 1919 on, is that there doesn't appear to be any inquest on the rebel side, if you like, on the revolutionary side, in terms of looking for people who might within the movement or on the margins of the movement, who might have given information and who might continue to give information. And that's very striking, that there isn't a sort of a crazy, not crazy, but that there isn't a very focused hunt for sources. And the sources, not necessarily to punish them, but perhaps to manipulate them, to use them for disinformation and so on and so on. I think that's very striking, and it's such a contrast with what happens from 1919 on. First of all, a targeted assassination, which again we hadn't seen in 1916 of key policemen and so on. And secondly, 1920 and 21, what became in some parts of the country a very, and yet not at all in a place like Belfast, which itself is a puzzle, but a very frenetic hunt for alleged informers and for spies. And can I say on spies, I'm not disagreeing with Jerry's definition, but in practice, the term spy is used very loosely the independence movement and by individuals within it to describe people. It doesn't necessarily mean that if somebody's a spy, they were in the organization and were working for the other side. It's very often used for civilians and even for captured police and military sometimes. Thanks.
So spy and informer are kind of interchangeable as terms in practice, you seem to be implying.
Yeah, very, very, very much so. I mean, it's, you know, it's a kind of a, we wouldn't want to be too technical in distinguishing one and the other. Sure. Obviously, for example, military officers in civilian clothes are effectively, you could call them either spies or agents, but they're quite different from a local postman who's suspected of giving information, but who isn't in the Republican movement or anything like it. Thanks.
Now, Andy, could I just go back to you? Like, could you just outline the different British intelligence agencies? Because obviously you're implying there's kind of turf wars, internal rivalry between them. Just briefly, just list the different agencies. Like, I'm aware, for example, that MI5 had its origins in anti-IRB, anti-Fenian activity way back, going right back into the late 19th century. Just outline the different agencies.
Okay, well, obviously...
Yeah, British intelligence agencies.
Yeah, so the British naval intelligence would have been independent. Obviously, the biggest source of information would have been the RIC traditionally and even during the war. And of course, within the RIC, you also had the DNP in Dublin, which was a law unto itself also. Then you had Army intelligence. And you also, of course, had MI5 operating in Ireland. So you had at least four, if not more, different agencies operating and gathering intelligence. And the thing about them was that they were all quite siloed and separate, so that they didn't share information effectively. And in a way, they were competing with each other. And this continued to be a problem during the War of Independence, the extent to which they shared or cooperated. I mean, they did cooperate, but not in the most effective way. British intelligence would have been a lot better if there was cooperation in a centralized filing system, which MI5 did during the First World War very successfully. They had a central filing system, and unfortunately in Ireland for the British, they didn't have that.
But was there any coordination at all? And if there was, you know, such as it existed, like, you know, where did all this information go? Did it go to any central point?
Well, that's the problem, is
it
went to different central points.
Okay.
So, you know, the army had its own central points, but it obviously had a number of regional centres, like the 6th Division in Munster. The police also, obviously the castle, but there was also stuff going to London, and all this stuff was going in different directions, and this was part of the problem. It was siloed, it was held within each section.
You wanted to come in on that?
Yeah, just a couple of things. Tommy, MI5 was founded in relation to the sort of the German spy scare in the early 1900s, in 1908, 1909. It was a special branch was founded in the 1880s specifically for the Fenian problem. But more generally, can I say, as well as looking in Ireland, we have to look at places like the United States in particular, because I think we have to understand that British are looking for high-level political intelligence as well as what we tend to focus on, which is where arms dumps are kept or where there's a notorious gunman or these kind of local and in some ways tactical things. And what we know least about high-level intelligence, either in North America amongst the Irish diaspora or indeed, for example, during the treaty negotiations about what the British knew and how they obtained information relating to personalities within the Irish delegation and so on. And I think there's a danger in discussing intelligence from the British side that we focus too much on the weaknesses and lack of coordination and particulars, which relating very often to operational matters. And we have to wonder where the British were getting and what kind of high-level intelligence they were getting on, if you like, the separatist leadership and so on. And that's a big gap. And I think that one of the problems with the sources we now have, which are so fascinating in detail, is they do bring us back into the detail of the sort of micro-stories of individuals and so on at local level. And what we miss is the big picture stuff, just as we think in terms of the more recent Northern Ireland troubles, where we're much more aware of how the British and the Americans, and indeed the Irish, for that matter, are looking at the political leadership of the Republican movement again, and trying to figure out who are the players, how can we influence them, and that's what we're missing entirely, it seems to me, for the period from 1919 to certainly 1922. Thanks.
Okay, you know, I put you on the spot here. We're missing it, but would you hazard to speculate, like, what do you, in your assessment, how good was the British high intelligence on the Sinn Féin and IRA movement during the War of Independence?
Well, I think it was probably quite good in the United States, not in terms of personalities and so on, and perhaps in terms of manipulating opinion within the Irish sort of politicized diaspora. I think also that by 1921, it was clear to senior figures within the British administration in Ireland, for example, the head of the RIC, Sir Joseph Byrne, who gets pushed out in consequence, that Sinn Féin is not a single sort of mad Bolshevik body, that there are many shades of opinions there, and that British policy should be working towards finding, if you like, the right people and the right groups on the rebel side with whom to start talking, which is, of course, what happens. And those kind of decisions are informed, whether formally or not, partly by information and analysis of the different individuals and the different strands within the separatist movement.
Okay, Gerry, can I bring you in here just to shift the focus onto the other side, right? The IRA. I'm always reminded of that famous Leo Whelan painting, which hangs in the National Museum Collins Barracks of IRA GHQ. I'm always amazed, you know, the disparate ways all the different people in that painting go, you know, whether it be Ono Duffy or O'Donovan or Michael Collins or whatever. But looking at the GHQ structures, right, there was a director of intelligence, and of course Michael Collins famously held that role. When did that GHQ structure come into place? I mean, does it go right back to the founding of the Volunteers 1913? When does it emerge?
Just before we touch on that, Tommy, if I may just pick up on bringing things back down to the tactical level in relation to the elements of British intelligence operating in Ireland. I know Andy mentioned the DMP, the Dublin Metropolitan Police. Well, within that, we had G Division, which was formed way back when to deal specifically with revolutionary activities in Ireland. And they were deemed to be fairly successful. In relation to the British Army, they were hampered by the system of rotation. Bear in mind, they were strangers in a foreign country, and units would have rotated and officers would have rotated relatively frequently. And that would have, you know, rather than allowing individuals or units to build up a picture of their opponents, that would have hampered them. In relation to IRA intelligence, right, you have to realize one thing, that military organizations react in response to a perceived threat. So evidently, enemy intelligence or British intelligence was perceived as a threat. And when the Volunteers were formed, they didn't have any, back in 1913, or as it evolved up into 1916, they didn't have any dedicated intelligence department. I think it was March 1918 that GHQ formed an intelligence department. In fact, the first director wasn't Michael Collins, it was Eamon Duggan. Michael Collins at that stage, I think, was director of organization for the IRA or Volunteers and also adjutant general. But he was doing his own bit in the background through his IRB connections, establishing his own little individual network. Duggan himself proved basically ineffective. And I think it was around March or April of 1919 that Collins took over as director of intelligence. Now, in Michael Collins, we have to say, we had the volunteer or IRA volunteer headquarters had somebody who was charismatic, ruthless, intelligent, cunning, fearless, somebody who commanded loyalty and was able to give loyalty in return, somebody who was able to talent spot, pick good subordinates, and somebody who recognized the value of intelligence and the value of fear, and immobilized intelligence and fear as a weapon of war.
Well, the next question, Gerry, I had here was, you know, has Collins' role been exaggerated? But from what you've just said there, the answer seems to be a resounding no, you know, that his role hasn't been exaggerated. I might just leave that and move on, right? Because I want to bring in Cecile here. Cecile, obviously, you know, you're involved in the Penton Files project, an absolute treasure trove of information. Now, you sent us a document just in preparation for this discussion from the number 2 Northern Division. Just explain the document that you sent us. What is it and what's in it?
It's actually it relates to the fifth Northern Division IRA. So we're talking north. It's like a three brigade area located in Cavan and Monaghan. And the document in question is contained in the brigade activity reports. That's the series in which it is, and it sets out the formation of a secret service intelligence department. So there are points regarding the structure of the intelligence department, meaning the reporting structure, how the lines of communication works, but there are also points concerning how observations, what to observe, how investigations were to be conducted, what to look for. So because it relates to the north, obviously some points and some language might, you know, just ring a bell, oh, it's definitely the Northern Division. But when you read a particular points, it does sound like something that's you know, like you were saying, universally, you know, recognized as
it's kind of generic, it seems to
it's
me.
It can be taken as generic. Now the document is undated, so you know, but it's sound in the sense that it really describes what to do and how to do it.
There's a reference to the Belfast boycott, which might date about spring of 22.
Early in 22. But you know, it could be late 1921 as well. So there are two points that I think, you know, we thought were more interesting because it really refers to informers and spies. It's short, so I'm just going to read the first one about informers. Informers among civil population. There are many of these. Watch movements and associations of suspected person, ex-police, unionists, so that's the language there, hostile members of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, travelers, peddlers, tramps, girls assisting in draperies and pubs, and servants in houses who are not local. And then the second point is about spies.
Can I just come in there? Because I want to just interrogate this a little bit, right? First of all, I mean, is this just downright misogyny? You know, girls assisting in draperies and pubs. What about boys? Like, you know, why are girls singled out? No, I mean, it's a serious point. That's one thing. The other thing is, I noticed that travellers are travellers with a small t. So I presume they're not talking about the people who pejoratively be referred to as tinkers.
We now refer to
with a big T. Traveller just means traveller. So tinkers, and again, I use the pejorative word advisedly because that's the word people have used, are not listed here. Whereas they are one of the groups mentioned, for example, Peter Hart's list of potential, potential targets of IRA.
It definitely has to go back into the proper context of the time. Yeah, that's not what we're talking about. And girls, I think it's there's an awareness that women were used for as a network on grassroots network for intelligence gathering, draperies. I don't know, pubs. Certainly, we have several instances of, you know, all over the country, not just close to the north, of women being identified, again being told not to join Communement, not to be too visible, and use either their, you know, because they were interesting in the sense of their geographical area or where they were working or who they knew, and being told just keep your ears and your eyes open, you know, and report to that guy or that guy. And women on the ground were very linked with flying columns. So they would tend to report to the officer commanding in the flying column or to designated a trustworthy person. So that's,
I might come back to you on the question of, of women later, right? Now, if you want to just move on to the section. Actually, Cecilia, before you move on to the spies, could I just bring Eunan in there for a comment? The list that Cecilia just read out there, is that a reflection of prejudice or just common sense? You know what I mean? In other words, is this a list of, you know, does this reflect prejudice against like peddlers, tramps? Or is there a utilitarian aspect to this? Is it related to what was actually happening? Just...
I think in terms of suspected people as distinct from what Cecile was talking about latterly, which was people who could help, as it were. For example, women, by not joining Communement but by serving in a post office or whatever, might do great service. But women are also suspect, obviously, as the IRA have particular difficulties with what they call sometimes lady spies and women spies and girls, various other terms, because they don't know quite how to deal with them, because there's a diffidence about about, certainly about killing them. And there's quite a lot of scraps of correspondence with GHQ and so on saying, well, can we do this? We've destroyed her house. We've done this. This young one, we bobbed her hair, but she refuses to stop and so on. So the treatment of there is a sort of a very sort of gendered element to what might be seen as the problem of girls or women who are believed to be giving information to crown forces. The more general thing of prejudice, I mean, there were a lot of what we now call homeless people. There was a sort of tramps in when I was a schoolboy, the term I got from English comics and things, of people wandering around. And obviously people who move from area to area conceivably can pick up probably very fragmentary and local information, but they are also the most vulnerable. They're different, they're others, and they're obvious suspects, whether fairly or not. But most of them weren't master spies. Most of them weren't people who came under suspicion, who weren't necessarily attacked or killed, but were in fact just, you know, soldiers, ex-soldiers shattered by the war, or they were people who had, if you like, an itinerant in the sense of moving lifestyle forever. But they naturally came under suspicion because they moved around and because they weren't part of a particular...
Isn't it true that the British used, they dressed up guys as tramps and so on as cover?
Oh, there's no question that sometimes happened, probably by at local level. I mean, Sir Kenneth Strong, in his own memoir, describes himself incredibly, and perhaps he was lucky. He was in King's County in Offaly, where they only really started killing spies in the last few weeks of the conflict. But he dresses up as an intelligence officer. He dresses up in sort of grubby old clothes and gets a donkey or whatever and wanders around and says he picked up no useful information whatsoever. There's no question that this was done on the British side. There's no question that some people who did this were detected and were killed. But nevertheless, it was, if you like, these social, very broad social categories did lend themselves to suspicion attaching to individuals, many of whom plainly were not master spies, had no reporting relationship with anyone, but were might be unpopular locally because they were outsiders and because they were dirty and whatever.
Andy, you want to come in with a quick comment there?
Yeah, a lot of the girls who came under suspicion, the women who came under suspicion, would have been those associating with Crown forces or with soldiers in particular. So on the suspect list, there would be a lot of women who were on that list in the 1st Southern Division list. The tramps and peddlers, the Cork IRA was expelling them from the county. Anybody coming into the region who was unknown came under suspicion. The other interesting thing on the list is the term unionists rather than Protestant. Loyalists would come under, they were watched more carefully. Loyalist households were policed more carefully than nationalists.
Andy, can I go back to Cecile, because just to continue with this document, just to finish up on, because it bears on your point about the expulsion of tramps. Cecile, could you just continue on to section 5 of that document on spies?
Section 5, spies. Every stranger or suspicious-looking individual in your area must be kept under close observation and movements carefully noted. Do not be deceived because they wear a green collar or talk Irish or say they are on the run. There is no one on the run in the division unless you're our own men, and these, as a rule, will be in their own or an adjacent county area. Do not accept written introductions or signatures as genuine. Pay particular attention to accent. So again, because, you know, we're close to the north, just, you know, a word of caution. Don't, you know, if they look Irish, if they talk Irish, that doesn't mean anything. But it completely encourages some sort of, you know, slightly paranoia about whoever is not local, whoever talks Irish. You know, you can really feel people will be looking at each other quite a lot.
That thing about accents is quite interesting, because in a previous life I worked in Ring's End Power Station, and people used to maintain there was a difference between the Ring's End and the Irish town accent. You believe that? But I'll move on. Andy, can I come back to you, because Eunan made the point there in terms of high intelligence. He remarked that Sinn Féin wasn't a centralized vanguardist organization like the Bolsheviks, right? But did the Castle think they were? In other words, did this lead them up the wrong path? In other words, did they think they were dealing with a highly centralized revolutionary movement?
Yes, I think to a large extent they did, and that their intelligence efforts seemed to center a lot more on Dublin in the first phase in the 1920s, in 1920. And, of course, Collins' operation was, you know, a lot of it was confined to Dublin. How far Collins' impact outside Dublin has been exaggerated, I think it certainly has. So there's a sort of war going on between Collins' squad in Dublin and British intelligence, and they put more people in to go after Collins on the assumption that if they take out the leadership, the whole thing will collapse. But of course, the IRA, GHQ's leadership was only nominal. The IRA in reality was much more highly regionalized. And it took a long time for British intelligence to get up and running outside Dublin. This is one of their shortfalls.
So that would have operated presumably in the IRA's favor, the fact that they weren't centralized from an intelligence point of view.
Yeah, I think it very much did. It was really only when the army, by the beginning of 1920, realized that police intelligence was incredibly weak, that they started to build up their own intelligence, both in Dublin, but also in the 6th Division area and at a regional level. So they started building up in the 6th Division, they started building up lists of IRA members. And so they did produce a centralized list for the whole of the 6th Division area. And they began to gradually become more effective over 1920 in this respect.
Now, Cecilia, that document you gave us, that is a contemporary document, like drawn up at the time, because it seems to reflect then the fact that this supposedly underground army were producing a proliferation of documents, right? And Andy, maybe I'll come back to you. I mean, I'm always amazed by the amount of stuff that they were producing that could potentially fall into the castle's hands.
Yeah, and actually, all those documents as well. These are precious documents, and you can if you look at it takes a lot of research. But if you look at individual files in the MSPC, here and there, you will find that also key people and especially women were engaged in, you know, in getting those documents and keep them safe to avoid them falling into the wrong hands. So even those documents are a part of the type of stuff that with money, with gold, and with other documents, everything was precious, and women were also used to keep those stuff, this material safe as well. And actually, this document is the only one I know of in the brigade activity files. If you look at the brigade activity files and you search for, you know, key terms like spy, informer, you will get, incidents. But again, they're not, it doesn't go through how the intelligence was gathered. It doesn't really go through about, you know, it doesn't really explain how the operation was planned. It's very, very matter of fact. You know, this happened, we kidnapped them, we killed them, and that's it. You do have to cross-reference with individual files to find more meat to get a bit more information.
Yeah, I mean, you can see this particularly towards the end of the War of Independence, these monthly activity reports for each battalion, brigade, they sort of come piling in the last few months. But I think there's a disjuncture between the extent towards which GHQ is running the show. You know, they're gathering all this activity reports and so on, but actually they're not really directing things at all. Things are being run at a regional level.
Sorry, Jerry, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, Tommy, I mean, just in relation to the report, like the divisional structure came in April 1921. And while there's some, we'll say, bits in that report on document relevant to the Northern Division, I'm quite sure the vast majority is generic. And it's just, I think it's important that we look at the development of the IRA intelligence. And by 1921, Collins, or we'll say the intelligence structure, they had operatives in the British military establishment, in Dublin Castle, in post offices, in hotels, in the trade unions, in a whole variety of different locations. throughout the country. Like, these were all people that were giving, in some cases, very high-grade intelligence at local level and also at national level. And, of course, when you talk about counterintelligence, we must also bear in mind the formation of the squad.
Jerry, can you just hold that sound? I'm going to come back to that in a second, right? I just want a quick comment from Eunan, because I want to move on to a different aspect of this. Eunan, you wanted to comment on this part of the discussion, just very briefly.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is we had the GHQ circulars and so on, which get boiled down as in Cecile's document. We have to be careful because I think Andy is right. GHQ is attempting to assert control and to turn the IRA into a conventional army and so on. A lot of these documents reflect this desire for organization and so on, which mightn't be there on the ground. But a key point, just on the Crown side rather than the British side, is the RIC were outstandingly good at taking the temperature of the country, except for Dublin, and that's a chronic problem. Dublin is dealt with by the Dublin Metropolitan Police, who only have a tiny subset, even within the G Division, of people who do any kind of like political intelligence, and their work is almost entirely just shadowing people, seeing who attend meetings and things. They're not, as it were, penetrating with a very few exceptions, seditious organizations and so on. And so we have to be really careful. The other point is that for all the mastery of the IRA in some ways, GHQ's whole, it's in vast amounts of its own records were captured in two different raids in Dublin in 1920 and early 21, which rather suggests that the British did figure out ways to see just as the Irish did the British were not unsuccessful, not only in tracking individuals down, but also in getting a grip of the other side's records even. I mean, there's a phenomenal loss in GHQ records for 1920 because the British captured them, I think, somewhere behind the Shelburne Hotel, and the originals have disappeared, although there are wonderful glimpses in surviving documents. So we have to be careful. And the British plainly get much about, Danny mentioned the army in particular, they get extremely sort of bureaucratized, but also very effective in cross-referencing and collating and in keeping material independently from the people who gathered it. The problem the RIC had was that every policeman carried his own notebook essentially in his head.
Right? Okay, and once he was bumped off, that was it.
You shoot the policeman, you shoot his memory. You shoot an army intelligence officer in 1921. There's a filing cabinet. There's cross refs. There's all the things copied, learned particularly in the First World War in terms of separating information from the person who gathered it. Thank you.
Now I want to just move on to something else here, and that's the role of terror here. And this is where this is at the blurred edges of what intelligence and counterintelligence. I mean, the very title of this this head school, spies and informers beware. Andy, can I bring you in on this? The terrorizing, like, effect of an informer being bumped off, left to the side of the road, right? And at the same time, then, if there was a logic to that, what was the logic of disappearing something? Because you had an article recently in the Irish Times about that. So could you just deal with those two things? Because on the face of it, they seem to be contradictory.
Okay, I mean, the logic of disappearance is that, firstly, it provided a better opportunity to interrogate victims. Obviously, if you heavily suspected the victim, you wanted to find out about their network, their contacts. And so if you disappear them, you can do that more slowly. They're often held for 3 or 4 days and obviously extensively interrogated. Secondly, it gave you time to catch up with the rest of their network because they didn't know that if someone was killed openly, often people fled because their associates had been killed, whereas if they were disappeared, that didn't happen. And then the other thing is, of course, that it avoided reprisals. The British didn't have a target for reprisals. So that was another benefit of disappearing.
Just on the question of interrogation, right? Do we have any evidence of the use of torture on either side? Because I'm sure we're all familiar with that scene in the film, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, rivaled only by that famous Nazi dentist in the film, The Marathon Man, right? Which always makes me cringe. I mean, is there any evidence that torture was used? And in any case, how useful was any information extracted on a torture in any case? Gerry, any comment on that?
Well, I mean, there's two incidents that spring to mind. One is the famous case where Tom Hales was captured down in Bandon, and there's quite evidence on it, along with somebody else whose name escapes me at the moment, a member of the 3rd Brigade, and they were extensively tortured, fingernails picked out, plucked out and all the rest of it. And from the IRA perspective, down in Knock Raha, there was some evidence on various tapes acquired by the Knock Raha Historical Association of a young boy, Parsons, being tortured as well. So torture, as bad and all as it is, there would have been incidences going, you know, throughout the conflict on both sides.
You need a comment on that, because you were in a previous head school with us on one of your forebear, Kevin Barry, right? And the song famously says, you know, he was tortured, right? But you were maintaining that he was roughed up. I mean, obviously not pleasant, right? But you any comment on this aspect of things?
I don't. There's any doubt that all the protagonists when they caught somebody were likely to be abused anyway. We've hundreds of accounts from volunteers and even civilians of being beaten up and even tortured who had done nothing, and just because they were shinners or alleged to be shinners. But the general question of the use of torture, I don't think you could say so. There's no question in the castle in particular that people were brutalized in 1920 and in 1921. There's so many accounts. They aren't, you know, these aren't propaganda. They may have been propagandized, some of them, like in the case of Kevin Barry. And the people were, but whether there's a case there, for example, in Monaghan, a young fellow called Larmer, I think is his name, who was beaten up and gave information and then came out and told the local IRA he had given this information, could be beaten up, and ridiculously on the orders of the local commander, he was executed. So I think anybody seeking information, the police historically in Ireland as elsewhere were inclined to rough up suspects anyway. So I don't think it would be surprising if brutalization of prisoners in order to get information wasn't, and still, if it isn't still a practice in lots of jurisdictions.
Cecile, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, there was also, there's a lot of question marks. Obviously, torture is not explicitly referred to, but question mark of, you know, people being interrogated, saying one thing, and they're interrogated by somebody else, and they say something different. That's probably the case in the case of the execution of Patrick Joseph Darcy in June 21 in County Clare. We have also... in an indication in his case that, for example, members of his family were attacked to get him out, to get to him. His brother was drowned, and then there was a question mark again about the body of his brother being dragged out of the water after being drowned and you know, concealed in the bog. So attack on family members of people, you know, suspected was seemed to have been something as well. Although it's very, again, plenty of question mark in the files. Obviously, they don't go through many details. But that's a really interesting case to have a look at when it comes to the treatment of someone whom, you know, even his membership was in question, whether he was IRA or not IRA, and his relationship with Liddy, who was the main guy, the Sean Liddy, the brigade commander in the area. That's a very interesting case.
Now, just to move
things on. Could I come in there?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Andy. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly, very important information was taken from prisoners, you know, probably as important as informers in many instances, but also captured documents. Union was talking about the British Army and the police cooperating finally. I mean, this did happen, but it happened very, very late in the day. And we're talking April 21 onwards, you know, only months before the end of the War of Independence. So when the British did finally get their act together and started collating a good picture, captured documents were very important, but also information gathered from prisoners, and some of them certainly under torture.
Now, just Jerry, I just want to go back to you because you were about to talk to us about Collins Squad and I cut you off. So just go back to that. Like, when was that formed, you know, and how effective was it?
Well, Collins started loosely forming a squad in the summer, I think, of 1918, selected individuals whose sole purpose was assassination.
Now, that's before he's director of intelligence, yeah?
Well, I'm just saying he started loosely, identifying individuals. Then, like I said, it was put on a more formal footing later on with approval from GHQ. And the role of counterintelligence, I think it was probably Collins' most effective weapon because he did bring the fight directly to the detectives of G Division. And yes, like Ewan said, that information would have been stored, but he did wipe out sort of key individuals there. And I thought the, like I said, he mobilized fear and put it to war as well, which I think is very important because you often heard saying paralyzed with fear. And there's no doubt that some individuals, and we can move on to Bloody Sunday, and the effects of that, how it impacted on the overall intelligence service is questionable because agents can be replaced. And as Ewan pointed out, information has already been stored. But without a doubt, like I said, it did inspire fear.
So you're saying, Jerry, that the assassinations of Bloody Sunday morning, you know, were a terror operation primarily rather than an intelligence operation in many senses?
Well, it was an intelligence-based, but like I said, it probably inspired fear because, like, while all those killed were definitely not intelligence operatives, there was a rush to the castle by people looking for their own safety.
Okay, so it put the fear of God in them, basically.
Absolutely.
Now, Cecile, how is the squad and say those assassinations dealt with in the pension files?
You mean Bloody Sunday?
Yeah.
Bloody Sunday, it's, again, not a lot in terms of preparation and gathering of intelligence. And again, in the Brigade Activity Reports, it's actually very disappointing because there's not a lot there. It seems to us that the bigger the event, the more well-known the event in retrospect, the less it's talked about in the files. And what you have to do for Bloody Sunday, you have to go again to the individual files. Our archivist, Michael Keane, listed 153 men and 12 women that we found in the collection that were linked to the event itself. And if you go through the individual files, so obviously we would aim at the people in the squad, and people like also James Bird, and you can see it's part the reluctance to talk about it or part of it's well known, I don't have to talk about it. You know, it's like Bloody Sunday is like a box to tick in front of the referee and the advisory committee. They don't expand much on it. I took part in Bloody Sunday. Obviously, people from the squad would be known and nothing would be put into question. So it's more a very matter of fact. And it seems to be the case for all these operations. And you find the same kind of language. Quite cold, quite, you know, we did that, we burned the house down, we killed them, and that's it. So it's also clear that the people who do not have files in the collection, like Cahill Brew and Sean Russell, who did play some part in the operations, did not mention the fact themselves during, you know, if they were providing a reference for somebody else. But in some cases, for example, with Frank Thornton, they do discuss their role in the intelligence part, but, you know, not the manner in which targets were selected or anything like that. So you have to dig through the individual files for this. But the list of 153 men and 12 women is for now the most complete we've ever had. So it's the largest operation that's documented in the files.
No, Cecile,
can I come in?
I
think one of the really significant things about Bloody Sunday is who gets hit, which agents are successfully killed. I think there's probably at least eight who are definitely intelligence. The important thing is that they seem to be all military intelligence. They're not police, they're military intelligence. And I think that's quite significant. I think at this stage, November 20, the army intelligence is becoming more important. The agents that are being sent in, and it's not just in Dublin, but it's also in other parts of Ireland. They're military intelligence agents particularly.
Now, another aspect of the War of Independence was the whole underground political structures, the underground Dáil, and the raising of funds, right? Now, because that also had to be protected, and coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, Collins was also the Minister for Finance. Eunan, can you just, what steps were taken to protect that? Because, I'm trying to remember the name of this accountant who was getting pretty close to various funds controlled by the movement, and he was bumped off. Just could you talk to us about that? I've forgotten his name.
Yeah. This is an interesting assassination because it's very early, and it's an example of a very particular kind of targeted killing, which you might have expected in 1916. I mean, 1916 is amazing because they don't go after key people within the, if you like, the castle system who know a lot about them. Whereas in March 1920, a retired resident magistrate who before that had been an RIC district inspector with particular knowledge of Irish political crime called Alan Bell, is taken off a tram just on Merrion Road near coming into Ball's Bridge, and he's shot dead by Liam Tobin and others. And what Bell had been doing was making inquiries about the financial side, if you like, of the separatist movement. He'd been interviewing bank managers, things like that. And he apparently, because he wasn't a well-known figure, and it was only when somebody got I think Michael Knightley might have been, found a photograph of him in an old newspaper and passed it on to Collins' organization that they identified him and were able to kill him. But it stands out, A, because you're right, Tommy. He was looking into finances. He was also looking into the attempt on Lord French's life in December 1919 at Ashtown. He was making inquiries about that as well. His notebook, actually, or one of his notebooks, is in the National Archives in Kew in a school kind of copybook. And he records there quite a lot of what he was doing. And plainly, he was doing, if you like, a paper chase rather than trying to find informers and so on. But he clearly, because of the money, that's why he was assassinated. And he was a man in fact, he was an old man. He was my age, I think, 66 or 67. He was unarmed. He was just dragged off the tram. "We want you," I think one of them said to him, might be Mick McDonald. They drag him off the tram and they shoot him dead. And that was pretty early in the game. It was March 1920.
Okay, now I want to just come back to Cecile, because you've mentioned the role of women in this whole business. Could you just talk to us about that? Like, just who were the women on the Irish side, if you like, who were providing information, channeling information?
Well, there were many of them, and actually, in important places like Dublin Castle, but also, more locally at their own level around the country. And it's kind of interesting to see that Michael Collins seemed to have met them in person, all of them, wherever they were acting, where they were active. There's always a mention, I met Michael Collins there and then in that office, in that house. So he's very willing to actually, to meet those women. One of them, her profile is well known now, Lily Mernin, who was active in Dublin Castle. Again, never joined Cumann na mBan. Direct contact with Michael Collins. Obviously, she was related to Piers Beasley as well, who introduced her to Collins in 1919. And she had been working for 7 years in the British Civil Service, so she knew her stuff and working in Dublin Castle in the A branch. She did that until 1921. She's single-handedly responsible for getting the addresses and descriptions of British officers, intelligence officers, and others in Dublin Castle. She got the address of civilians working there with, remarks of their on their sympathies and places they were regularly going to. She gathered useful information like car plates numbers and reported overheard conversations, and she was helped by many conversations with a direct conversation with the daughter of Superintendent Dunn, for example, who was friendly with some British spies, and some of them, like McMahon and Peel. McMahon was killed during Bloody Sunday, so she did a lot of things like that. And then people like Josephine O'Donoghue in Cork, people like Annie Smith, who was sister of John Brennan. So, you know, connected to GHQ, also connected to Collins. So she worked in Dublin and Dublin Castle as well. And she was asked to get in contact with Robert Collins of St. Albans Road in Dublin. And Bob, that's how he's referred to in the file. Bob was a personal friend of hers. And he managed a canteen in the lower castle yard at Dublin Castle. And that canteen was opened specially for the use of the military and the auxiliary police force. And Annie was to work there and to obtain information from Bob relating to the treatment location of prisoners in the castle, the habit of the new police force. So there are many of them working on their own at their own level. Obviously, Lily Mernin, because of Dublin Castle, is very well known now. But there are so many of them who have met Michael Collins in person and who were asked by him directly to do certain things. Many women were again used because they had access. We have, for example, Madge Barnes, who had access to British military premises due to the fact that she was a wholesaler in vegetables and things like that. So, you know, with food stuff, she had access to all these premises. She can overhear conversation. Sometimes, you know, with different sympathies, she was attending functions with British military. And again, overhearing conversations and reporting. Many women were reporting daily to someone, daily with either verbal dispatches or written stuff. And it's like we will need at some stage to basically draft a listing of all these women, who what they did on the ground, because the amount of women who met Michael Collins, you know, it's just starting to get really long. So that'd be in itself an interesting topic, actually, to write about.
Now, I'm assuming most of these women did not hold any former positions in the coming them on, or the IRA, no. Certainly. Did they get pensions, therefore?
They do. Under the 1934 Act, intelligence is one of the headings. Now, you would need to get your references in order. And usually, you know, it can be very difficult, because if you're acting undercover, maybe, you know, it is possible that only one person knew what you were doing. And it's the case, for example, for Josephine O'Donoghue. And it's Flory O'Donoghue who is writing her reference for her intelligence work in Cork. And he's reluctant to do it because he's noting in his letter that they're related and he doesn't want to do it. But if he doesn't do it, no one will know and she won't get a pension. But they do get pension for intelligence work, providing that references are strong enough to corroborate what they're claiming. Yeah.
Now presumably the use on the IRA side of female informants, that might be the reason why they suspected shop girls. In other words, if we're using them, they assume the other side must be using them, you know, in a similar way.
Most definitely. I think they're very aware of that. But it's also the fact that, you know, like you were saying, that was interesting. They can't kill them. You know, I'm sure it's a burden to them because they can't get rid of them as easily as maybe men. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying it's an annoyance to them. So what they do is like they get them, they're deported or they're, you know, they chase them out of town, they close their businesses and they intimidate their family members. That seems to be, and also what the women are getting is like this everyday violence towards the home, towards raids. And that's coming to the fore as well. That's taking a toll on you know, health in later life as well. So we'll get a lot more of that in the collection
now,
as well.
Now, Andy, I want to move on to the very controversial question of the IRA assassination of suspected informers, right? Just let's crunch a few numbers here. How many suspected informers were killed overall?
I think in the whole country at this stage, for the War of Independence alone, we're probably looking at almost 200.
200, okay.
And of those, about 72 would have been in County Cork.
Well, that was my next question, right? Now, that is what, about a third of the entire... Okay, so a third of the suspected informers are in Cork. Now, of course, that has to be measured against the fact that 25% of the overall casualties are in Cork. So are those figures roughly in alignment, or the fact that it's a third, it's a bigger proportion of reformers are bumped off? Any significance there?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's particularly a Cork One Brigade, which accounts for probably 80% of them in Cork. I've got an intelligence system which is picking up more than in other areas. And of course, they have a good source of intelligence in Victoria Barracks, the centre of the 6th Division. They've got very good intelligence there. So they're able to identify informers probably more successfully and elsewhere. And I think this is why the numbers are a lot higher.
Okay, can just throw in something. See, County Clare, for example.
Can I come in there? I think there's a logical problem here. How is it that, for example, in Belfast, which was, you know, the third most violent place, if you take Antrim as a county, in the War of Independence, how is it the IRA don't kill a single informer?
Yes, right? Indeed.
Okay. Yeah. How is it that in Dublin they kill relatively so few civilians? And Dublin is the centre. From the British point of view, is the place that matters most. I'm sorry, it's not Cork, it's Dublin, because that's where the revolutionary government is and so on. That's where IRA General Headquarters is. And the IRA killed, we think, I think it's about 20, 25 civilians whom they believe to be agents or informers. And there's a particularly, I think the argument that there's more informers killed, civilian informers killed in Cork, picking Cork number one brigade, simply because it shows Cork intelligence is better, is ludicrous. It's the opposite, that they're killing on a whim and on suspicion to a much greater extent. And in fact, they conceal, as you know, the records show, they conceal a lot of these killings, not simply from the victims' families, but from GHQ. And in the case, for example, the notorious case of Mrs. Lindsay, which is in some ways a separate question, the local IRA lie about Mrs. Lindsay consistently to Dublin. Dublin thinks at the time of the truce, thinks she's still alive. Cathal Brewer gives an order saying she should be released.
I think
there's a particular problem, sure, especially in Cork number one, which cannot be explained by saying, oh, they were better in Cork number one than they were, say, in Dublin or elsewhere at identifying civilian things. I think it's to do with the brigade commander and a kind of a pathology almost that he adopted in relation to anybody against whom there might be any possible suspicion. You just kill them just to be sure.
Jerry, you want to come in on that, on the rationale for the killings in Cork?
Well, first of all, I think when we're looking at the intelligence war, Tommy, I think we have to sort of quote Donald Rumsfeld here, that we're dealing, no matter, despite all the documentation that's been available, we're still dealing with the known unknowns in this case, you know. And if we're looking at Cork, whether it was on the whim of Sean O'Hagerty, due to his personality, or based on high-level intelligence, the evidence is we don't really know at the moment. I mean, there are good arguments on both sides of that particular question. But in relation to the rationale behind it, you know, I'll give you another quote from the British historian Sir Michael Howard. We make war as we can rather than as we should. And that sounds very dismissive of any sort of atrocity or horrendous act that's committed in war, but it's really, really very true. The rationale behind the execution of spies is, you know, rather than deporting them, it's really down to individuals, as opposed, you know, I think we all agree that there was no centralized command and control structure from GHQ. So it really boils down to the individuals. Some people would look at and say, look, if I leave this individual alive, my own men are threatened. The lives of my own men are threatened. The operational effectiveness of my own unit is threatened. So therefore, wipe them out, get rid of them. You know, like I said, it's really down to the individuals. And unfortunately, we're not in the place to get inside their minds to see how they acted.
I tell you what, can I go back to Cecile on this, right, about Mrs. Lindsay, because it's been mentioned several times here. I want to be sure that all our listeners are up to speed on this. Cecile, if you just very quickly, just without any comment, just give us the bare bones of what happened to Mrs. Lindsay. Why was she killed?
Okay, so very quickly, the IRA basically discovered that Mrs. Lindsay of Lehman House near Coachford was a person who had supplied...
She was Protestant, of course, right?
She was Protestant. Yes. She supplied the British authority and a local priest in particular with information about an ambush set at Godfrey's Cross in Cork. And following the sentences to death by a court martial...
Cecile. Yeah. She told the IRA, she told the priest to tell the IRA she was doing this. So they didn't discover it. She informed
them. Correct. She informed them and then it was known, basically. And then following the sentencing to death of several men captured by the British, it was, you know, again...
Yeah, so just make this clear. So as a result of her information, several IRA guys were
got captured there.
And then sentenced to death.
The ambush, their position was given away. The British surrounded the men positioned in ambush. And after that, Bastide decided on a course of action. Basically, he thought that kidnapping Mrs. Clark and her driver, Mrs. Lindsay and her driver, James Clark, thought that would prevent their execution.
So they were hostages.
They were kidnapped on February the 17th, 1921. So, and then it drags on for a whole month. They keep her. There's like a couple of files of a woman as well called Mary Hurley, who basically said that for a whole month she was bringing Mrs. Lindsay books to keep her occupied. It's noted as well in the file and in the book by O'Callaghan that Mrs. Lindsay had lost a stone. And then the personality of Bastide comes through as well. He's ruthless. And you can really feel that after a month of dragging these two people, they're becoming a burden. They don't really know what to do.
Yeah, but the IRA guys captured are executed, are they not?
Yes, they are executed.
Yeah, but the point is, if you take hostages and threaten to kill them, if your guys are killed, then, if you don't follow through with that, you know, what's the point to take any further hostages?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Commander decided to ignore the priest's warning. So it's not a matter that because of Mrs. Lindsay, simply the disaster happens. One guy is killed and five more end up being executed. The point is he had hours and hours in which to withdraw his men, and he didn't do so because he decided the priest was, quote, always preaching against ambushes. So he ignored the warning that the priest gave him. That was a bad call. He completely destroyed his own battalion through his incompetence and his serial lying about the whole matter.
Yeah.
So obviously he is feeling defensive then about this. I mean, which might explain, you know, the quote unquote overreaction. Sorry, Jerry, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, just to follow through what Eunan said, I think he covered it. I mean, the basic tenet in military operations is once your ambush position is compromised, you get out of it. You know, exit straight away. You know, it's pointless staying there. But again, as Eunan pointed out, these guys did stay there. But what is interesting, even though Mrs. Lindsay and her chauffeur, who was completely innocent, were dispatched, nothing at all happened to Father Shinnick.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Andy, can I bring you back in there, right, on the general question, right? And you can comment on Mrs. Lindy as well. I mean, to what extent were these kind of assassinations nakedly sectarian?
I think that has the extent to which there was sectarianism in these killings has been very exaggerated by Peter Hart. And I think that's misleading because 71% of the spies killed during the War of Independence were actually Catholic. And the big thing was the ex-servicemen were the people who were targeted most. That accounts for, I think, 56% of all of the victims. So that was much more important. But I'd like to come back to the point that Eunan was making. I just disagree with Eunan on that. The Cork One IRA was gathering superior intelligence. And I've looked at all 72 cases quite carefully now. And I think I could confidently say Hart concluded that the great majority of them had nothing to do with intelligence. But I would say that the majority would have been involved in intelligence and in informing. But there was a substantial minority who were innocent.
Yeah, this is this one of the problems with intelligence and counterintelligence, right? Because and this brings me on to my next question, right? Now, we know of, you know, IRA moles within the British system, you know, the Ned Broys, etc. But we don't know of any British moles within the IRA, or do we? And the point is, even if they existed, how would we know? In other words, the best infiltrators are the ones you never rumble. How do we address that conundrum?
I mean, that's a very fair point. And they aren't necessarily infiltrators, but people who are turned. And there's no doubt that some people, no doubt through coercion, very often, perhaps through inducements, did turn, but typically after being captured or interrogated or whatever, and did supply information. There's one company officer, I think he's in Bandon, I can't remember precisely now, whom Major Percival in particular, giving a lecture in 1923, talks about, and he Percival presents it as saying, we said we'll let you be and we'll leave your farm alone, we won't raid you too much if you just help us out with our local problems. And I'm sure that happened in other cases. I think the ones who are identified typically, like that unfortunate alarmer in Monaghan, tend to be the ones lower down, and they're the ones who get, as it were, get punished. But I'm sure that at some level, in some parts of the very wide separatist movement, there were people, not necessarily infiltrators, but maybe working on the civilian side and so on, who were giving information for one reason or another. And very often it's a complex matter. Sometimes people will give some information but not give others. We look at the complexities of informing in the more recent Northern Ireland troubles. At the high level, I would like to know about the highest political levels, and particularly during the treaty negotiations and so on. And that's a sort of a big gap in the records, unfortunately.
Well, Eunan, on that, right, is there still information locked up in British archives on this question that has yet to be mined?
No, I would say there's very little. I'd say there's scraps right. of material and all documents. They wouldn't necessarily be locked up. It's that they have, for one reason or another, they haven't surfaced. But for example, I presume that they bugged Hans Place, where the Irish legation was there, because they did that in 1920 to the Russian trade legation with whom they were negotiating. So they would have bribed servants. They would have all these quite routine things, and that kind of surveillance. The records of that have disappeared, and I think it's a great pity. Also, they plainly would have watched the key Irish players in London, who they were associating with, what they were doing, and so on and so on, and all that material. I'd say it has gone, not because the Queen is still hiding it, but because most of these kind of records, after a time, got lost, got destroyed, just weren't kept. But it is a pity, because it's the high level people that we should think about, and to what extent Lloyd George, for example, was guided by people advising him on, look, you can go this way, not that way, you can press him, don't press him, bring these issues up. And to some extent, that would have come from some kind of analysis, which to some extent would have derived from some kind of surveillance and intelligence, or so I think.
Okay, I just to keep an eye on the time here, lads. I don't have to wrap up here, right? I just want to throw in a final question here. Who won the intelligence war, or does the activity of one side cancel out the other? Is it a draw? Jerry.
Well, in relation to who won, I think if we go back to the original war aims of both sides, did the IRA get their independent republic? No. Did the British or the Crown forces manage to eliminate the Republican threat? No, it didn't. In relation to how much intelligence led to that outcome, the compromise, for want of a better word, there's no doubt in my mind that it did play a very important part. As to who won, it's very hard, but I would say the IRA probably intelligence shaded it slightly, in that they prevented, IRA intelligence prevented the Republican movement from being defeated.
Okay, Andy.
In terms of the intelligence aspect of the question, I think you'd have to say that overall the British intelligence effort was a failure. They only really began to get to grips with it. They adjusted very slowly, and they really only began to get to grips with things very late in the day. And ultimately, it was too late.
Eunan, I give you the last word on this. And you did refer to the recent Northern conflict. Is the difference here that the recent Northern conflict just lasted for decades as opposed to years? Is that the difference?
Well, I think there are lots of differences, but just to tell you, in 1984, I wrote a sentence, the IRA had won by not being defeated. And I think that's the case in terms of intelligence. But we have to, I think we have to think more systematically about the term intelligence generally, where we, as you quite rightly said, Tommy, assassination, for example, isn't necessarily, and it's the product of intelligence rather than an intelligence act. Most of the intelligence people I've ever met, if they knew somebody was on the other side, the last thing they would probably do is contemplate killing them, because instead what you do is you watch them, you feed them disinformation and so on and so on. So this linking of the idea that killing somebody proves how good your intelligence is I think it's logically doesn't really stand up. Thank you.
Okay. I tell you guys, I want to wrap this up here. I mean, as everyone said, there's so much more to be researched and written about this. But I'd just like to thank our panel here today, Andy Bielenberg, Cecile Gordon, Ewan O'Halpin, and Jerry White. And our next Hedge School, which will be posted on the 5th of February, will be to mark the centenary of the death of Catherine O'Shea. And we're going to discuss the proposition, what if she and Parnell never met? So I hope, listeners, you will tune in for that. Thank you very much.